supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The former Port Authority chair of New York and New Jersey, who pleaded guilty to using his position to coerce a United Airlines flight to his vacation home in South Carolina, will not serve jail time. WBGO's Ang Santos says the prosecution disagrees with the sentence handed down today.
David Sampson was sentenced to a year of home confinement, 4 years of probation, 900 hours of community service, and a $100,000 fine. Paul Fishman is the U.S. District Attorney in New Jersey.
That was, of course, not the sentence that we requested. We requested that the court sentence Mr. Sampson to a meaningful term of imprisonment of 24 months. I have enormous respect for Judge Linares. He obviously struggled with that decision and saw the case differently than we did and took into account the circumstances of Mr. Sampson's life and experience and thought that was the appropriate sentence.
Sampson's defense handed out a written statement after the decision that says his sentence is fair and called his actions an aberration. Original error in judgment. For WHYY News, I'm Ang Santos in Newark.
Members of New Jersey's congressional delegation say last week's threats against a Jewish community center in Cherry Hill show that federal officials cannot overlook religious centers just because they're not located in a major city. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports.
U.S. Senator Cory Booker came to the Katz Center in Cherry Hill as a show of solidarity after false bomb threats were called in there last week in Cherry Hill, as well as other sites around our region.
Hatred cannot go without a response, because bigotry cannot be allowed to go without being shouted down by a chorus of love.
South Jersey Congressman and fellow Democrat Donald Norcross says he and the senator are working to bring more Homeland Security funding in order to protect places of worship. He says facilities in South Jersey have been overlooked in the past since they're between New York and Philadelphia.
This is a fight that we're all in together. A, to drive out hate, and number two, to make sure funding is there for you when you need it.
Norcross says religious centers in the North Jersey suburbs close to New York City have benefited from this funding, as well as some on the Philadelphia side of the Delaware River. Cherry Hill Mayor Chuck Kahn says he'll put together a working group to help with the situation.
We must remain vigilant. That's why my office will be forming an advisory group of religious, cultural, and community leaders in the coming weeks that we hope will identify and address the issues and take back all of this that we have and the issues that we have locally.
Booker didn't stay for questions after speaking to the crowd of about 100 that set up in the parking lot of the center, saying he had to catch the train to Washington. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Activists have quickly put up an encampment on a farm in Lancaster County to try to block construction of the Atlantic Sunrise gas pipeline. They're taking inspiration from protests by Native Americans against the Dakota Access Oil Pipelines. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports that the camp is just one of many pipeline battles in Pennsylvania and across the country.
There's a big barn in southern Lancaster County with freshly painted red letters on the side. It reads, "Welcome to the Stand." Mark Clatterbuck is one of the activists with the group Lancaster Against Pipelines, leading the charge against the Atlantic Sunrise. It's a new $3 billion pipeline designed to move natural gas southward through 10 Pennsylvania counties.
Okay, so right behind us is this old historic tobacco barn that we're using as kind of the base of the kind of base of operations, where that's where we're storing donations. Food donations, as well as supplies, camping supplies, tarps.
The owners of this property in Conestoga Township refused to make a deal with Williams, the company behind the Atlantic Sunrise project. Now, portions of the farm may be taken through eminent domain. But the opponents are organized. The campsite has a food truck, a large military tent, a pair of portable toilets, and on a recent Saturday, crews were installing power in the barn.
Yeah, we're running electric and we'll run cable here so we have internet as well.
Nearby, about two dozen people rehearse scenarios for nonviolent direct action.
And we, the majority of the people, are silenced more and more. And until we stand up in masses, that's not going to change.
While the pipeline construction hasn't started yet, the camp emerged in mid-February, shortly after federal regulators approved the project. Someone is here around the clock. So far, about 24 people have camped out on weekends, with fewer people staying during the week. Molly Wallace lives in Leola and says she's probably too much of a wuss to pitch a tent and stay overnight, but she wants to make her voice heard.
Yeah, I'm willing to get arrested. It's a cause worth getting arrested for.
This cause is at the center of other battles over the Mariner and Penn East pipelines in Pennsylvania and other big projects in places like Louisiana, Florida, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. While pipelines aren't a new thing, this nationwide proliferation of projects is, and it's all because of the shale boom, which unlocked huge reserves of natural gas and oil. Chris Stockton is a spokesman for Williams. He says the supply center for fossil fuels has shifted dramatically.
You know, pipelines are one of these things that's they're normally out of sight, out of mind. People don't give a whole lot of thought to them or think about where their natural gas comes from. But you know, this shale development has really turned our industry upside down.
And while President Donald Trump is viewed as friendly to the oil and gas industry, Williams CEO Alan Armstrong warned his colleagues at a conference earlier this year in Pittsburgh that they shouldn't get too complacent because of this new administration.
That is not changing the opposition that we have at a local level. And we're going to continue to see that. And I would tell you, it may even enhance.
It's true activists are taking tips and inspiration from each other. Stephanie Graybill runs the kitchen at the Langster encampment.
I have one here.
Her food truck is painted like a cow with black and white spots and fits right in on the farm. She's one of several people from central Pennsylvania who traveled to North Dakota for the Standing Rock protest last year.
I was scared. I was scared because it was so cold. I'd never experienced weather like that in my life. And the wind, it was just brutal.
But now she's sitting out in the sunshine on an unseasonably warm winter day with her two daughters, 21-month-old Ella and 12-year-old Maddie, who's strumming the ukulele. Graybill says about six people she met at Standing Rock are making their way out to Pennsylvania in the next few weeks.
I think Standing Rock's the playbook for camps like ours, because we're tired of government pushing us around. They're supposed to be working for us, not working against us.
It's unclear how this encampment will unfold. At times, violence erupted between law enforcement and the North Dakota protesters. And in Florida recently, a man was killed by police after he fired a gun at pipeline construction equipment. But so far, the Lancaster activists seem to have a positive relationship with officers. Corporal John Mishner of the Southern Regional Police stopped by to share a weather warning.
I mean, I just stopped down because I heard on the radio there's a severe thunderstorm warning for the area, and I wanted to make sure they were aware.
And as opponents continue to organize against their pipeline, Williams says it respects the rights of people to protest peacefully. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Philadelphia's soda tax has been in effect since the first of the year, too soon to gauge its long-term effect, though a recently published paper called Regressive Sin Taxes points to variables that may determine its ultimate success or failure. Joining me is study co-author Benjamin Lockwood, assistant professor of business economics and public policy at Wharton. Professor Lockwood, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a definition. What's a sin tax?
So a sin tax is a tax on some good that that policymakers are concerned might have adverse consequences for the people consuming it. So health consequences or something like that, that people aren't taking into account when they make the decision. So it's important to emphasize, you know, there are some things that have harmful health consequences like driving that we don't tax because we think people broadly take that into account when making their decisions, but for things like soda or cigarettes, we're concerned that the long-term health consequences might not be fully internalized when people decide how much to consume.
And that's part of the key. Driving, an accident happens in a moment. With cigarettes, alcohol, soda, these are long-term health effects we're talking about.
That's correct.
And so what is the price point when you bring in the term regressive? Is that trying to determine, in this case with Philadelphia, 1.5 cents per ounce, that price point whereby it will actually serve as a deterrent?
Yeah, so the concern here is that on the one hand, sin tax has this intended consequence of reducing consumption of a harmful good like soda. But on the other hand, there's a concern that taxes on these sorts of goods might fall more heavily on poorer consumers. And that's really what we mean when we talk about regressivity. So poorer consumers tend to consume soda, also cigarettes, at higher rates than richer consumers. And so the concern is that a tax on that sort of good might adversely affect the poor in particular. Now, the countervailing issue is that because the consumption initially has negative health consequences, then people who reduce their consumption the most in response to the tax actually get the resulting health benefits. So the real key concern here, the real key question, is whether people respond a lot to the tax, whether they reduce their consumption in response to the tax, or whether they go on consuming the same amount regardless.
Back to that 1.5 cents per ounce, could an argument be made that it would be more effective if it was 5 cents, 10 cents, a dollar an ounce? What's the right pitch point?
No, that is really the key question in all of this. And we are starting to see some very initial estimates of what the response is like to these taxes. But I think we really need more evidence over, which we will have over the next couple of years, as we see the response to these few cities that have started passing soda taxes. Now, I can say that based on the very early estimates that we've seen so far, it seems reasonable to guess that the middling estimates probably entail a tax somewhere around the size that Philadelphia or Boulder at 2 cents an ounce, that somewhere around the size of those taxes, maybe even a little larger than those taxes. But again, I can't say for sure until we have some better estimates that come out over the next year or two.
Talk about naysayers who say this is yet more evidence of a nanny state. And of course, they use that term as a pejorative.
Right. So this is why it comes back to this key question about whether people are taking into account the negative consequences of soda consumption, of sugary beverages, when they're making the decision. So I, like many economists, are very opposed to taxes that sort of get in the way or impose regulation when people are making sensible decisions for themselves. On the other hand, there's a growing body of behavioral economics literature that suggests people tend to overweigh the costs or benefits of something that happens right up front and then underweigh the costs or benefits that happen a long time in the future. And that can help make sense of everything from why you exercise less than you might intend to why you save too little for retirement. And so now that we have that big body of behavioral evidence, you can make a similar argument for things like soda taxes. So there's really a strong amount of evidence suggesting that people might be making these kinds of systematic mistakes. And in that case, the potential is there to actually help them and help their health outcomes by trying to correct those things that we know, those kinds of psychological biases that we know many of ourselves are subject to.
Interestingly, the Philadelphia tax also applies to diet soda. Were there health implications also being concerned about what additives are used in those drinks?
So I actually think that part of the motivation for the tax on diet soda had to do with the fact that diet soda is not consumed as much by poorer consumers as it is by richer consumers. So it was thought to be a way of partially offsetting the regressivity of taxing sugary soda itself. Unfortunately, again, from the economics perspective, thinking about helping people correct their health mistakes, the key policy goal is really to get people to stop consuming the thing that is harmful health-wise. So the argument then is really stronger to apply the tax specifically to sugary beverages and let people substitute away to diet sodas and the like if that's what they'd rather switch to.
Professor, I'm going to open a bottle of sugar-free seltzer here and toast your efforts. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks very much for having me.
Benjamin Lockwood, Assistant Professor of Business Economics and Public Policy at Wharton. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org.
It's a sin, my darling, how I love.
It's been a long time since Clint Konopka missed a day of work. 2,575 days, to be precise. The South Philadelphia High School physics teacher is among a small cadre of city educators who've gone at least 2,500 days without taking time off. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron offers this profile of the Philadelphia School District's Iron Man.
Our story starts in a navy blue touring van outside a nightclub in New York City. Clint Konopka's punk rock band was on the verge of breaking up, and Konopka was looking for a new line of work.
Yeah, I'm just like, screw this, I can't do it anymore, I'm going to become a teacher.
After angrily tapping out an application on his cell phone, Konopka eventually landed at Academy of Palumbo, a magnet school in South Philadelphia. Since he started, he hasn't missed a day of work. In part, that's because Konopka really loves physics. Also, it's really annoying to be absent.
Like, trying to set everything up for a sub and making sure kids actually learn stuff and do stuff is so much more work than just, like, you know, popping those, like, Alka-Seltzer cold and flu things and just, like, propping yourself up through coffee, like, through the whole day and just suffering through it and doing it.
Konopka does not hold the Philly record for most consecutive days without taking off. A teacher who chose to remain anonymous has gone 3,782 days, or about 10 years, without calling out. And the easygoing Konopka won't make it that far. On May 19th, he's taking his first ever personal day so he can watch one of his first ever students graduate from college.
Way more important than keeping up a streak.
As the bell rings and students file out on a recent Friday afternoon, Konopka stays behind. He's got to prepare the school debate team for a Saturday tournament. It's no big deal, he says. After all, at this point, what's a few more hours on the job? I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin, WHYY News.
Prepare for a pre-spring spring ahead this Sunday. Let's turn to the calendar with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Ah, daylight saving time, but what's this? Looking at the calendar, last Friday, all eyes in the city were on Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Congratulations and explanation, please.
Thank you very much for the congratulations, Dave. It's an interesting thing that happened to me last Friday. I was recognized by Mayor Kenny of the city for the work that I've been doing in astronomy, space education, science education during my career at Franklin Institute. But actually, this comes as the result of a project that I was involved in last summer. A group of upper elementary school students in Delaware are authors. They write books about people of influence. And so they chose to write about me. Tough for me to say, but happy to work with the kids. So they wrote the book, had it published, and this is a project that they do pretty frequently, and the books that are written are published and then distributed throughout the Delaware State Library system. So, as a result of me being chosen to be one of the subjects, they wrote a book about me. It's now available through the Delaware Library system, and word got through to the city, and the city thought it might be appropriate to recognize my work and connection with this book. Although, I have to say, while I really do appreciate the recognition for what I do, it really is about the kids that wrote the book and my desire to want to support them as they grow and learn what their capabilities are.
I'm here to say that you've inspired kids of all ages to look aloft, lo, these many decades. And what's more exciting than the thought of more manned missions to the moon? There are now at least two players, SpaceX and NASA.
The new administration sent out a directive to NASA asking them to initiate a study to determine if the first test flight of NASA's new heavy lift launch vehicle called Space Launch System, it's scheduled for late 2018, if that could be converted into a manned circumnavigation of the moon.
Quite a challenge. So far, there isn't room for that overhead bag.
Oh boy, it's more than that. You know, right now, the way the capsule is built, the Orion capsule, it has no life support systems in it at all. And construction of that capsule for that first test mission has already been going on, so it would have to be retrofitted to be able to accommodate crew. But looking at this a little bit more realistically, this is only a request for a study to be made about what the feasibility would be.
Have we now again prioritized going to the moon before going on to Mars?
You know, nothing's really clear at all. Ambitious plan, yes, but it muddies the water because where now do you put the dollars, the few dollars that NASA has? Or will NASA's budget be raised accordingly on a mission that includes humans? The last thing you want to do is drive up the risk by reducing the amount of time for engineering development and testing, or not having adequate funding to do all the testing that needs to be done.
We could devote an entire day talking about the challenges for science, and in this case, astronomy, trying to advance within the context of a political season. Let's put that aside, though, and look at what's happening on the calendar. Daylight saving time.
Thank goodness the clockwork nature of the universe continues to operate flawlessly and without the interference of politics or humans. Yes, coming up on Sunday at 2 a.m., We'll move our clocks forward 1 hour, and we'll move into daylight saving time. So
it's not completely devoid of politics. It was Congress that mandates the state.
Yes, you're right. There is some politics in this, because it was not quite a decade ago that Congress decided to shift the dates of the change of time around both spring and fall in an effort to try to determine whether or not altering the start and end of daylight saving really could have an effect on energy consumption and savings. So that's going to be a very long-term study to determine what is the right time if we're saving by moving the time around. But nonetheless, it still is a harbinger that spring is on its way.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Space is the place. Space is the place. Space is the place, yeah. Space is the place.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Vinyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Space is the place. Space is the place. Space is the place.